Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours. Greetings, Pulpsters, and welcome to issue 23 of Protecting Project Pulp, the podcast that each week slips the bonds of temporal convention, sidestepping the decades to retrieve glittering story jewels from the golden age of pulp fiction and delivering them directly into your ears. I'm your host, Dave Robison. And this week we're pleased to present the conclusion of the epic tale we began last week, The Tree of Life by Catherine Lee Moore, more widely known as C.L. Moore, first printed in the October 1936 issue of Weird Tales. Now, I know you're eager to get to the tale, but I only gave you half of Moore's life story last week, so let me wrap that up real quick, and then we'll get to the story goodness. Now, when last we left our heroine, she had married fellow pulp author Henry Kuttner. This was a partnership made in heaven. Kuttner and Moore collaborated so well together that nearly all the stories they published after they were married were written together under various pseudonyms, most commonly Lewis Paget. The combination of Moore's lyric style and Kuttner's more cerebral storytelling was superb, and they were very prolific. They even collaborated on a story that combined Moore's signature characters, Northwest Smith, and Jurel of Jewry, titled Quest of the Starstone in 1937. After Kuttner's death in 1958, Moore wrote almost no fiction at all and taught his writing course at the University of Southern California. She did write for a few television shows, but upon marrying Thomas Reggie, who was not a writer, in 1963, she stopped writing altogether. Catherine Moore was an active member of the Tom and Terry Pinkard Science Fiction Literary Salon and was a frequent contributor to literary discussions with the regular membership, including Larry Niven, Jerry Purnell, Robert Block, and others. Over time, she developed Alzheimer's and stopped attending meetings. She was a great favorite, however, of the Science Fiction Writers of America. But when she was nominated to be the first woman Grand Master of that august assemblage, the nomination was withdrawn at the request of her husband. He said that, due to Catherine's condition, the award ceremony would be at best confusing and likely upsetting to her. Your narrator is, of course, still Jeff Lane, author and podcaster of fiction at jefflaneaudiobooks.com, as well as at iTunes and Podiobooks. Now, back to the world between the worlds with us. Northwest Smith is in a jam and has set his course to unravel the horror of the mysterious Thag.
Whatever Thag might be, his power in this land could not be doubted. He made up his mind suddenly what he must do, and turned to the breathlessly waiting little folk. "Which way lies Thag?" he asked. A score of dark, thin arms pointed. Smith turned his head speculatively toward the spot they indicated. In this changeless twilight, all sense of direction had long since left him. But he marked the line as well as he could by the formation of the trees, then turned to the little people with a ceremonious farewell rising to his lips. "My thanks for—" he began, to be interrupted by a chorus of whispering cries of protests. They seemed to sense his intention, and their pleadings were frantic. A panic anxiety for him glowed upon every little terrified face turned up to his, and their eyes were wide with protest and terror. Helplessly, he looked down. I must go," he tried, stumbling to say. "My only chance is to take Thag unawares before he sends for me." He could not know if they understood. Their chattering went on undiminished, and they even went so far as to lay tiny hands on him, as if they would prevent him by force from seeking out the terror of their lives.
No. No. No.
They wailed murmurously.
You do not know what it is you seek. You do not know, Thag. Stay here. Beware of Thag.
A little prickling of unease went down Smith's back as he listened. Thag must be very terrible indeed if even half this alarm had foundation. And to be quite frank with himself, he would greatly have preferred to remain here in the hidden quiet of the hollow, with its illusion of shelter, for as long as he was allowed to stay. But he was not of the stuff that yields very easily to its own terrors, and hope burned strongly in him still. So he squared his broad shoulders and turned resolutely in the direction the tree folk had indicated. When they saw that he meant to go, their protests sank to a wail of bitter grieving. With that sound moaning behind him, he went up out of the hollow, like a man setting forth to the music of his own dirge. A few of the bravest went with him a little way, flitting through the underbrush and darting from tree to tree in a timidity so deeply ingrained that even when no immediate peril threatened, they dared not to go openly through the twilight. Their presence was comforting to Smith as he went on. A futile desire to help the little terror-ridden tribe was rising in him, a useless gratitude for their warning and their friendliness, their genuine grieving at his departure, and their odd, paradoxical bravery, even in the midst of hereditary terror. But he knew that he could do nothing for them, when he was not at all sure he could even save himself. Something of their panic had communicated itself to him, and he advanced with a sinking at the pit of his stomach. Fear of the unknown is so poignant a thing, feeding on its own terror, that he found his hands beginning to shake a little and his throat going dry as he went on. The rustling and whispering among the bushes dwindled as his followers one by one dropped away, the bravest staying the longest. But even they, failing in courage as Smith advanced steadily in that direction from which all their lives they had been taught to turn their faces. Presently, he realized that he was alone once more. He went on more quickly, anxious to come face to face with this horror of the twilight and dispel at least the fearfulness of its mystery. The silence was like death. Not a breeze stirred the leaves, and the only sound was his own breathing, the heavy thud of his own heart. Somehow he felt sure that he was coming nearer to his goal. The hush seemed to confirm it. He loosened the force gun at his thigh. In that changeless twilight, the ground was sloping down once more into a broader hollow. He descended slowly, every sense alert for danger, not knowing if Thag was beast or human or element, visible or invisible. The trees were beginning to thin. He knew that he had almost reached his goal. He paused at the edge of the last line of trees. A clearing spread out before him at the bottom of the hollow, quiet in the dim, translucent air. He could focus directly upon no outlines anywhere, for the tapestried blurring of the place. But when he saw what stood in the very center of the clearing, he stopped dead still, like one turned to stone, and a shock of utter cold went chilling through him. Yet he could not have said why. For in the clearing's center stood the Tree of Life. He had met the symbol too often in patterns and designs not to recognize it, but here, that fabulous thing was living, growing, actually springing up from a rooted firmness in the spangled grass as any tree might spring. Yet, it could not be real, its thin brown trunk of no recognizable substance, smooth and gleaming, mounted in the traditional spiral, its 12 fantastically curving branches arched delicately outward from the central stem. It was bare of leaves. No foliage masked the serpentine brown spiral of trunk, but at the tip of each symbolic branch flowered a blossom of bloody rose so vivid he could scarcely focus his dazzled eyes upon them. This tree alone, of all objects in the dim land, was sharply distinct to the eye, terribly distinct, remorselessly clear. No words can describe the amazing menace that dwelt upon its branches. Smith's flesh crept as he stared, yet he could not, for all his staring, make out why peril was so eloquent there. To all appearances, here stood only a fabulous symbol miraculously come to life, yet danger breathed out from it so strongly that Smith felt the hair lifting on his neck as he stared. It was no ordinary danger. A nameless, choking, paralyzed panic was swelling in his throat as he gazed upon the perilous beauty of the tree. Somehow, the arches and curves of its branches seemed to limn a pattern so dreadful that his heart beat faster as he gazed upon it. But he could not guess why, though somehow the answer was hovering just out of reach of his conscious mind. From that first glimpse of it, his instincts shuddered like a shying stallion, yet reason still looked in vain for an answer. Nor was the tree merely a vegetable growth. It was alive. Terribly, ominously alive. He could not have said how he knew that, for it stood motionless in its empty clearing, not a branch trembling, yet in its immobility more awfully vital than any animate thing. The very sight of it woke in Smith an insane urge to flight, to put worlds between himself and this inexplicably dreadful thing. Crazy impulses stirred in his brain, coming to insane birth at the calling of the tree's peril, the desperate need to shut out the sight of that thing that was blasphemy, to put out his own sight rather than gaze longer upon the perilous grace of its branches, to slit his own throat that he might not need to dwell in the same world which housed so frightful a sight as the tree. All this was a mad battering in his brain. The strength of him was enough to isolate it in a far corner of his consciousness, where it seethed and shrieked, half-heated, while he turned the cool control which the spaceways life had taught him to the solution of this urgent question. But even so, his hand was moist and shaking on his gun butt, and the breath rasped in his dry throat. Why, he asked himself, in a determined groping after steadiness, should the mere sight of a tree, even so fabulous a one as this, rouse that insane panic in the gazer? What peril could dwell invisibly in a tree so frightful that the living horror of it could drive a man mad with the very fact of its unseen presence? He clenched his teeth hard and stared resolutely at that terrible beauty in the clearing, fighting down the sick panic that rose in his throat as his eyes forced themselves to dwell upon the tree. Gradually, the revulsion subsided. After a nightmare of striving, he mustered the strength to force it down enough to allow reason's entry once more. Sternly holding down that frantic terror under the surface of consciousness, he stared resolutely at the tree, and he knew that this was Thag. It could be nothing else, for surely two such dreadful things could not dwell in one land. It must be Thag, and he could understand now the immemorial terror in which the tree folk held it, but he did not yet grasp in what way it threatened them physically. The inexplicable dreadfulness of it was a menace to the mind's very existence, but surely a rooted tree, however terrible to look at, could wield little actual danger. As he reasoned, his eyes were seeking restlessly among the branches, searching for the answer to their dreadfulness. After all, this thing wore the aspect of an old pattern, and in that pattern there was nothing dreadful. The Tree of Life had made up the design upon that well-top in Alar, through whose shadow he had entered here, and nothing in that bronze grillwork had roused terror. Then, why? What living menace dwelt invisibly among these branches to twist them into curves of horror? A fragment of old verse drifted through his mind as he stared in perplexity. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? And for the first time, the true significance of a fearful symmetry broke upon him. Truly, a more human agency must have arced these subtle curves so delicately into dreadfulness, into such an awful beauty that the very sight of it made those atavistic terrors he was so sternly holding down leap into a gibbering terror. A tremor rippled over the tree. Smith froze rigid, staring with startled eyes. No breath of wind had stirred through the clearing, but the tree was moving, with a slow serpentine grace, writhing its branches, leisurely in a horrible travesty of voluptuous enjoyment. And upon their tips, the blood-red flowers were spreading like cobra's hoods, swelling and stretching their petals out, and glowing with a hue so eye-piercingly vivid that it transcended the bounds of color and blazed forth like pure light. But it was not toward Smith that they stirred. They were arching out from the central trunk toward the far side of the clearing. After a moment, Smith tore his eyes away from the indescribable dreadful flexibility of those branches and looked to see the cause of their writhing. A blaze of luminous white had appeared among the trees across the clearing. The priestess had returned. He watched her pacing slowly toward the tree, walking with a precise and delicate grace, as liquidly lovely as the motion of the tree. Her fabulous hair swung down about her in a swaying robe that rippled at every step away from the moon-white beauty of her body. Straight toward the tree she paced, and all the blossoms glowed more vividly at her nearness, the branches stretching toward her, rippling with eagerness. Priestess though she was, he could not believe that she was going to come within touch of that tree, the very sight of which roused such a panic instinct of revulsion in every fiber of him. But she did not swerve or slow in her advance. Walking delicately over the flowery grass, arrogantly luminous in the twilight, so that her body was the center and focus of any landscape she walked in, she neared her horribly eager god. Now she was under the tree, and its trunk had writhed down over her, and she was lifting her arms like a girl to her lover. With a gliding slowness, the flame-tipped branches slid round her. In that incredible embrace, she stood immobile for a long moment, the tree arching down with all its curling limbs, the girl straining upward, her head thrown back and the mantle of her hair swinging free of her body, as she lifted her face to the quivering blossoms. The branches gathered her closer in their embrace. Now the blossoms arched near, curving down all about her, touching her very gently, twisting their blazing faces toward the focus of her moon-white body. One, poised directly above her face, trembled, brushed her mouth lightly, and the tree's tremor ran unbroken through the body of the girl it clasped. The incredible dreadfulness of that embrace was suddenly more than Smith could bear. All his terrors, crushed down with so stern a self-control, without warning, burst all bounds and rushed over him in a flood of blind revulsion. A whimper choked up in his throat, and quite involuntarily, he swung round and plunged into the shielding trees, hands to his eyes in a futile effort to blot out the sight of the lovely horror behind him, whose vividness was burnt upon his very brain. Heedlessly, he blundered through the trees, no thought in his terror-blank mind save the necessity to run, 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 until he could run no more. He had given up all attempt at reason and rationality. He no longer cared why the beauty of the tree was so dreadful. He only knew that until all space lay between him and its symmetry, he must run and run and run. What brought that frenzied madness to an end, he never knew. When sanity returned to him, he was lying face down on the flower-spangled sward in a silence so deep that his ears ached with its heaviness. The grass was cool against his cheek. For a moment, he fought the backflow of knowledge into his emptied mind. When it came, the memory of that horror he had fled from, he started up with a wild thing's swiftness and glared around, pale-eyed, into the unchanging dusk. He was alone. Not even a rustle in the leaves spoke of the tree folk's presence. For a moment, he stood there alert, wondering what had roused him, wondering what would come next. He was not left long in doubt. The answer was a shrilling very, very faintly through that aching quiet, an infinitesimally tiny, unthinkably far away murmur which yet pierced his eardrums with the sharpness of tiny needles. Breathless, he strained in listening. Swiftly, the sound grew louder. It depended upon the silence, sharpened and shrilled until the thin blade of it was vibrating in the center of his innermost brain. And still it grew, swelling louder and louder through the twilight world in cadences that were rounding into a queer sort of music, and taking on such an unbearable sweetness that Smith pressed his hands over his ears in a futile attempt to shut the sound away. He could not. It rang in, steadily deepening intensities through every fiber of his being, piercing him with thousands of tiny music blades that quivered in his very soul with intolerable beauty. And he thought he sensed in the piercing strength of it a vibration of queer, unnameable power, far mightier than anything ever generated by man, the dim echo of some cosmic dynamo's hum. The sound grew sweeter as it strengthened with a queer, inexplicable sweetness unlike any music he had ever heard before, rounder and fuller and more complete than any melody made up of separate notes. Stronger and stronger, he felt the certainty that it was the song of some mighty power, humming and throbbing and deepening through the twilight until the whole dim land was one trembling reservoir of sound that filled his entire consciousness with its throbbing, driving out all other thoughts and realizations until he was no more than a shell that vibrated in answer to that calling. For it was a calling. No one could listen to that intolerable sweetness without knowing the necessity to seek its source. Remotely, in the back of his mind, Smith remembered the tree folk's warning.
When Thag calls, you must answer.
Not consciously did he recall it, for all of his conscience was answering the siren humming in the air, and scarcely realizing that he moved, he had turned toward the source of that calling, stumbling blindly over the flowery sward with no thought in his music-brimmed mind, but the need to answer that lovely, power-vibrant summoning. Past him as he went on moved other shapes, little and dark-skinned and ecstatic, gripped like himself in the hypnotic melody. The tree folk had forgotten even their inbred fear at Thag's calling and walked boldly through the open twilight, lost in the wonder of the song. Smith went on with the rest, deaf and blind to the land around him, alive to one thing only, that summons from the siren tune. Unrealizingly, he retraced the course of his frenzied flight, past the trees and bushes he had blundered through, down the slope that led to the tree's hollow, through the thinning of the underbrush, to the very edge of the last line of foliage which marked the valley's rim. By now, the calling was so unbearably intense, so intolerably sweet, that somehow, in its very strength, it set free a part of his dazed mind as it passed the limits of audible things and soared into ecstasies which no senses bound. And though it gripped him ever closer in its magic, a sane part of his brain was waking into realization. For the first time, alarm came back into his mind, and by slow degrees, the world returned about him. He stared stupidly at the grass moving by under his pacing feet. He lifted a dragging head and saw that the trees no longer rose about him, that a twilit clearing stretched away on all sides toward the forest rim which circled it, that the music was singing from some source so near that the tree. Terror leaped within him like a wild thing. The tree, quivering with unbearable clarity in the thick, dim air, writhed above him, blossoms blazing with bloody radiance and every branch vibrant and undulant to the tune of that unholy song. Then he was aware of the lovely, luminous whiteness of the priestess swaying forward under the swaying limbs, her hair rippling back from the loveliness of her as she moved. Choked and frenzied with unreasoning terror, he mustered every effort that was in him to turn, to run again, like a madman, out of that dreadful hollow, to hide himself under the weight of all space from the menace of the tree. And all the while he fought, all the while panic drummed like mad in his brain, his relentless body plodded on, straight toward the hideous loveliness of that siren singer towering above him. From the first, he had felt subconsciously that it was Thag who called. And now, in the very center of that ocean of vibrant power, he knew. Gripped in the music's magic, he went on. All over the clearing, other hypnotized victims were advancing slowly, with mechanical steps and wide, frantic eyes as the tree folk came helplessly to their god's calling. He watched a group of little dusky sacrifices pace step by step nearer to the tree's vibrant branches. The priestess came forward to meet them with outstretched arms. He saw her take the foremost gently by the hands. Unbelieving, hypnotized with horrified incredulity, he watched her lead the rigid little creature forward under the fabulous tree whose limbs yearned downward like hungry snakes, the great flowers glowing with avid color. He saw the branches twist out and lengthen toward the sacrifice, quivering with eagerness. Then, with a tiger's leap, they darted, and the victim was swept out of the priestess's guiding hands up into the branches that darted round like tangles of snakes in a clot that hid him for an instant from view. Smith heard a high, shuddering wail ripple out from that knot of struggling branches, a dreadful cry that held such an infinity of purest horror and understanding that he could not but believe that Thag's victims, in the moment of their doom, must learn the secret of his horror. After that one frightful cry came silence. In an instant, the limbs fell apart again from emptiness. The little savage had melted like smoke among their writhing, too quickly to have been devoured, more as if he had been snatched into another dimension in the instant the hungry limbs hit him. Flame-tipped, avid, they were dipping now toward another victim as the priestess paced serenely forward. And still, Smith's rebellious feet were carrying him on, nearer and nearer the writhing peril that towered over his head. The music shrilled like pain. Now he was so close that he could see the hungry flower mouths in terrible detail as they faced round toward him. The limbs quivered and poised like cobras, reaching out with a snakish lengthening, down inexorably toward his shuddering helplessness. The priestess was turning her calm, white face toward his. Those arcs and changing curves of the branches as they neared were sketching lines of pure horror whose meaning he still could not understand, save that they deepened in dreadfulness as he neared. For the last time, that urgent wonder burned up in his mind. Why? Why so simple a thing as this fabulous tree should be infused with an indwelling terror strong enough to send his innermost soul frantic with revulsion? For the last time, because, in that trembling instant, as he waited for their touch, as the music brimmed up with unbearable, brain-wrenching intensity, in that one last moment before the flower mouth seized him, he saw. He understood. With eyes opened at last by the instant's ultimate horror, he saw the real Thag. Dimly he knew that until now, the thing had been so frightful that his eyes had refused to register its existence, his brain to acknowledge the possibility of such dreadfulness. It had literally been too terrible to see, though his instincts knew the presence of infinite horror. But now, in the grip of that mad, hypnotic song, in that instant before unbearable terror enfolded him, his eyes opened to full sight, and he saw. That tree was only Thag's outline, sketched three-dimensionally upon the twilight. Its dreadfully curving branches had been no more than Thag's barest contours, yet even they had made his very soul sick with intuitive revulsion. But now, seeing the true horror, his mind was too numb to do more than register its presence. Thag, hovering monstrously between earth and heaven, billowing and surging up, there in the translucent twilight, tethered to the ground by the tree's bending stem, and reaching ravenously after the hypnotized fodder that his calling brought helpless into his clutches. One by one he snatched them up, one by one absorbed them into the great unseeable horror of his being. That, then, was the reason why they vanished so instantaneously, sucked into the concealing folds of a thing too dreadful for normal eyes to see. The priestess was pacing forward. Above her the branches arched and leaned. Caught in a timeless paralysis of horror, Smith stared upward into the enormous bulk of Thag while the music hummed intolerably in his shrinking brain. Thag, the monstrous thing from darkness called upon by Alar in those long-forgotten times when Mars was a green planet. Foolishly, his brain wandered among the ramifications of what had happened so long ago that time itself had forgotten, refusing to recognize the fate that was upon himself. He knew a tingle of respect for the ages-dead wizard who had dared command a being like this to do his services, this vast, blind, hovering thing, ravenous for human flesh, indistinguishable even now, save in those terrible outlines that sent panic leaping through him with every motion of the tree's fearful symmetry. All this flashed through his dazed mind in the one blinding instant of understanding. Then the priestess's luminous whiteness swam up before his hypnotized stare. Her hands were upon him, gently guiding his mechanical footsteps, very gently leading him forward into... The writhing branches struck downward straight for his face, and in one flashing leap, the moment's infinite horror galvanized him out of his paralysis. Why, he could not have said. It is not given to many men to know the ultimate essentials of all horror, concentrated into one fundamental unit. To most men, it would have had the same paralyzing effect up to the very instant of destruction. But in Smith, there must have been a bedrock of subtle violence, an unyielding, inflexible vehemence upon which the structure of his whole life was reared. Few men have it, and when that ultimate intensity of terror struck the basic flint of him, reaching down through mind and soul into the deepest depth of his being, it struck a spark from that inflexible barbarian buried at the roots of him, which had force enough to shock him out of his stupor. In that instant of release, his hand swept like an unloosed spring of its own volition, straight for the butt of his power gun. He was dragging it free as the tree's branches snatched him from its priestess's hands. The fire-colored blossoms burnt his flesh as they closed round him, the hot branches gripping like the touch of ravenous fingers. The whole tree was hot and throbbing with a dreadful travesty of fleshly life as it whipped him aloft into the hovering bulk of incarnate horror above. In the instantaneous upward leap of the flower-tipped limbs, Smith fought like a demon to free his gun hand from the gripping coils. For the first time, Thag knew rebellion in his very clutches, and the ecstasy of that music, which had dinned Smith's ears so strongly that by now it seemed almost silence, was swooping down a long arc into wrath, and the branches tightened with hot insistency, lifting the rebellious offering into Thag's monstrous, indescribable bulk. But even as they rose, Smith was twisting in their clutch to maneuver his hand into a position from which he could blast that undulant tree trunk into nothingness. He knew intuitively the futility of firing up into Thag's improbable mass. Thag was not of the world he knew. The flame blast might well be harmless to that mighty hoverer in the twilight. But at the tree's root, where Thag's essential being merged from the imponderable to the material, rooting in earthly soil, he should be vulnerable, if he were vulnerable at all. Struggling in the tight, hot coils, breathing the nameless essence of horror, Smith fought to free his hand. The music that had rung so long in his ears was changing as the branches lifted him higher, losing its melody and merging by swift degrees into a hum of vast and vibrant power that deepened in intensity as the limbs drew him upward into Thag's monstrous bulk, the singing force of a thing mightier than any dynamo ever built. Blinded and dazed by the force thundering through every atom of his body, he twisted his hand in one last convulsive effort and fired. He saw the flame leap in a dazzling gush straight for the trunk below. It struck. He heard the sizzle of annihilated matter. He saw the trunk quiver convulsively from the very roots, and the whole fabulous tree shook once with an ominous tremor. But before that tremor could shiver up the branches to him, the hum of the living dynamo which was closing round his body shrilled up arcs of pure intensity into a thundering silence. Then, without a moment's warning, the world exploded. So instantaneously did all this happen that the gun blast roar had not yet echoed into silence before a mightier sound than the brain could bear exploded outward from the very center of his own being. Before the awful power of it, everything reeled into shaken oblivion. He felt himself falling. A queer, penetrating light shining upon his closed eyes roused Smith by degrees into wakefulness again. He lifted heavy lids and stared upward into the unwinking eye of Mars racing nearer moon. He lay there, blinking dazedly for a while before enough of memory returned to rouse him. Then he sat up painfully, for every fiber of him ached, and stared round on a scene of the wildest destruction. He lay in the midst of a wide, rough circle which held nothing but powdered stone. About it, rising raggedly in the moving moonlight, the blocks of time-forgotten Alar loomed. But they were no longer piled one upon another in a rough travesty of the city they had once shaped. Some force mightier than any of man's explosives seemed to have hurled them with such violence from their beds that their very atoms had been disrupted by the force of it, crumbling them into dust. And, in the very center of the havoc, lay Smith, unhurt. He stared in bewilderment about the moonlight ruins. In the silence, it seemed to him that the very air still quivered in shocked vibrations. And as he stared, he realized that no force save one could have wrought such destruction upon the ancient stones. Nor was there any explosive known to man which could have wrought this strange, pulverizing havoc upon the blocks of Alar. That force had hummed unbearably through the living dynamo of Thag, a force so powerful that space itself had bent to enclose it. Suddenly, he realized what must have happened. Not Alar, but Thag himself had warped the walls of space to enfold the twilight world, and nothing but Thag's living power could have held it so bent to segregate this little, terror-ridden land inviolate. Then, when the tree's roots parted, Thag's anchorage in the material world failed, and in one great gust of unthinkable energy, the warped space walls had ceased to bend. Those arches of solid space had snapped back to their original pattern, hurling the land and all its dwellers into... His mind balked in the effort to picture what must have happened, into what ultimate dimension those denizens must have vanished. Only himself, enfolded deep in Thag's very essence, the intolerable power of the explosion had not touched. So, when the warp space curve ceased to be, and Thag's hold upon reality failed, he must have been dropped back out of the dissolving folds upon the spot where the tree had stood in the space-circled world, through that vanished world floor, into the spot he had been snatched from in the instant of that dim land's dissolution. It must have happened after the terrible force of the explosion had spent itself, before Thag dared move even himself through the walls of changing energy into his own far land again. Smith sighed and lifted a hand to his throbbing head, rising slowly to his feet. What time had elapsed he could not guess, but he must assume that the patrol still searched for him. Wearily, he set out across the circle of havoc toward the nearest shelter which Alar offered. The dust rose in ghostly moonlit clouds under his feet.
You just heard the conclusion of The Tree of Life by Catherine Lee Moore, read by Jeff Lane. There is so much about that story that sets my mind spinning and sparking. Did you catch the Lovecraftian influence on the horror that was Thag, the interdimensional predator that feasted on the essence of living things? That concept of experiencing only a portion of a vast entity, the portion that somehow exists in our own reality, just blows my mind. I mean, you're listening to the story and you're just kind of going with it. Yeah, we're seeing the big toe of a vast dimensional thingy poking through into our time-space. Got it. Cool. But then, in those quiet moments, when all the really good stories come back to visit you, you try and figure out how that actually works. Now, I don't have the physics background to even begin to conjecture about how that would work. There's a feeling that I get when I think about it. It's like those sculptures you see sometimes, comprised of pieces and blocks of statuary scattered over like a 10-foot area. You look at it from one side, and there's just a jumble of shapes. But if you move around it, suddenly, from one perspective, the shapes resolve into a face or a figure, something recognizable. There's an almost audible click as your brain reassembles everything you think you're seeing and organizes it into something totally new that it actually understands. A lot of people talk about multiple realities and how they fold into each other infinitely, interwoven or coexisting. If we could just move to the right position, they'd resolve into something recognizable, even tangible. The metaphor that always meant something to me was the making of rock candy. Have you ever done this? You dissolve a bunch of sugar into a jar of water, and then suspend a string into the water. You can't see the sugar. Anybody looking at the jar would just assume it's a jar of water. But the presence of the string becomes an anchoring point for the suspended sugar, and suddenly crystals start to form on the string. It's like magic. Sometimes I think our lives, our reality, is like that jar of saturated water. I mean, we move through our day totally oblivious to the multitude of quiescent wonder and horror that hangs suspended around us. And our thoughts and actions are like that string, providing a foothold for those possibilities to become realities. Now, I'm betting you've had the experience of having something stick in your awareness, and then suddenly the whole world seems to be filled with that thing. Somebody shows you a cool picture of a duck, and suddenly there's ducks everywhere you look. Now, I'm not saying that if we think the wrong thing, we'll manifest a huge interdimensional life-sucking tree from the quantum potential around us. Well, not immediately, anyway. But I am intrigued about how it seems like we always find what we're looking for. Not necessarily what we want, but what we're looking for. Because often those are two very different things. If you're looking for a fight, I pretty much guarantee you'll find one. If you're looking for reasons why you can't be an author or a doctor or a business owner, then you'll find those too. But it works the other way too, you know. If you look for wonder, for reasons to hope or laugh or love, you'll find those too. Just don't look for huge interdimensional life-sucking trees, okay? Now, one guaranteed way to find what you're looking for is to look for awesome pulp stories every week. Ta-da! Here we are, the amazing team that brings Protecting Project Pulp to your ears and hearts each and every week. Fred Heimbaugh, our assistant editor, is not a huge interdimensional life-sucking tree. He's more like a mass of distinguished ivy, sending tendrils questing through the mortared stones of literature, ever questing for the radiant life-nurturing light of awesome pulp stories so we can bring them to you every week. Tom O'Dwyer, our sound engineer, is a lithe and supple willow, his undulant branches plucking sweet sounds from the air so they fall like rain upon our ears. And our editor and producer, Tony Smith, he's a mighty oak, roots sunk deep into the stories of the world, limbs and branches spread wide, providing shade and succor to all who delight in tales of wonder. And remember, you don't have to succumb to the life-crushing embrace of Thag to get awesome pulp stories every week, because you, my friend, can just saunter on over to iTunes and subscribe to us there. You can also throw down some roots at our website, www.protectingprojectpulp.com, and subscribe to our feed there. You can even spread some fertilizer, on the post or in our forums. I mean, really, the feedback does help us grow, so it's not a completely inaccurate metaphor when you think about it. We hope you enjoyed this week's tale. Next week, we're revving our engines in the quest for racetrack glory with a tale by Philip St. John titled Hell on Dirt Oval. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Robison, wishing you nothing but the finest adventures. I'll see you next week. This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.